you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
LAist Studios.
Hi, everybody. This is Retake. I'm your host, John Horn. I am now in Park City, Utah. That's the home of the Sundance Film Festival. Well, it had been until the pandemic canceled the last two gatherings and turned them into virtual affairs. This year, though, audiences are back and I'm back too. Now, if I can only find my mittens. In this week's episode, a wide-ranging conversation I had before I left LA with three friends and collaborators who also all happen to be Oscar-winning filmmakers.
We are in a decade where streaming came to maturity. It coincided with a massive world epidemic. We cannot know where the coin is going to land, if it's going to be heads or tails this year or next year. It'll take a decade to know where we're going.
That's writer-director Guillermo del Toro. You'll hear more from him later in the show, along with Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu and Alfonso Cuarón. But first, here's my conversation about Sundance with KPCC's Sharon McNary, who is sitting in for regular Morning Edition host Suzanne Whatley.
Welcome, John.
Great to see you, Sharon.
Well, thank you. You don't look too bundled up right now, but I know you're off to the mountains of Utah, most probably not to ski in all that fresh powder. What else is happening in Park City?
Well, I am not going to ski. I remember a time when I was able to. It just so happens something's going on up there. I'm going to give you an audio hint.
Rows and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way.
I really need to compose myself for a second.
John, you're tearing up.
I am. Every time I see this scene or hear this performance, I start sobbing. It's a clip from Amelia Jones singing and also performing sign language for Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. It's from the movie Coda. You might recall that writer-director Sean Hader's film won a little prize about a year ago. It's called the Best Picture Oscar at the Academy Awards, but Coda also debuted at the Sundance Film Festival. And that's where I am headed. The festival runs from today to the following Sunday. And a very interesting footnote, Amelia Jones, the star of Coda, has not one but two movies that are going to premiere in Sundance.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. Now, this year's festival's in person, so it's the first time since January 2020. So audiences will finally be able to see Sundance movies in theaters rather than on their laptops. So is there a Sundance movie from last year's virtual festival that could do as well in this year's Oscars as Coda did from last year?
Probably not among narrative films, but there are several documentary features that premiered at Sundance a year ago that I think are very likely to be named when the Oscar nominations come out next Tuesday. Yes, next Tuesday, right around the corner. Those include Fire of Love, Descendant, and All That Breathes. So let's see if I'm right about those Sundance alumni being nominated for a documentary feature next week.
Well, it does lead to a lot of awards, but why else do you consider Sundance to be important?
Well, I think it's even more important now than it has been, given that smart adult dramas are dying a rapid death at the box office. And it's important not only to showcase the best work made outside the studio system, but also Sundance is there to make sure these films get an audience. Coda is a great example. So it went to the festival 2 years ago without a distributor. The movie could have played at Sundance and nowhere else. But of course it didn't, because it's really good. Apple TV Plus bought it for no small sum and released it. So more than anything else, Sundance is a very important market for independently produced films. And it's where movies like Little Miss Sunshine, The Big Sick, Napoleon Dynamite, Blair Witch Project, all premiered, went there without a distributor, were bought, and went on to greater glory.
What films are you excited to see this year?
It's a very long list, and it's very hard to pick, you know, where you're going to be at any given time, because you always have about four or five choices at the same moment. I'm interested in a dramatic competition film called Theater Camp from star, writer, and producer Ben Platt. I saw him on Broadway in Dear Evan Hansen. This is a pet project of his. There's a movie called Passages from a director I'm very fond of named Ira Sachs. A dramatic premiere called The Pod Generation, starring one of my favorite actors, Chiwetel Ejiofor. A documentary called Beyond Utopia, which follows families trying to flee North Korea. Flora and Son is a movie from John Carney. He made a film called Once, you might remember, and then a dramatic competition film named Jonathan Majors. You're going to hear a lot about Jonathan Majors coming up. And then a documentary about Cher Height, who wrote The Height Report, called The Disappearance of Cher Height, a very controversial book when it came out. And I think Cher Height was not remembered well by history, even though she made a very important contribution to women's sexuality.
Wow, that's just amazing. Well, that theater camp does sound like a lot of
fun. It's my kind of movie.
Thanks, John.
My pleasure, Sharon.
Coming up after the break, they come from Mexico but have made it in Hollywood, often known as the Three Amigos, Alfonso Cuarón, Alejandro González Iñárritu, and Guillermo del Toro.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It was Netflix that brought them together the night I spoke with them earlier this month, but Guillermo del Toro, Alfonso Cuarón, and Alejandro González Iñárritu have known each other for a long time. Del Toro and Cuarón met each other first in the 90s when Cuarón was working in television in Mexico, and Cuarón and Iñárritu met through cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki. You'll hear him referred to by his nickname, Chivo, in this chat. Del Toro and Iñárritu both made films with Netflix this year, Pinocchio and Bardo, respectively. Alfonso Cuarón's Oscar-winning 2019 film, Roma, was also a Netflix film. So it was at a ticketed event put on by the streamer at the Academy Museum that I spoke with the three filmmakers ahead of their public conversation. And just to note, I was enjoying listening so much that I forgot to ask Alfonso to hand my mic back to me a couple of times. We've boosted the volume as much as we could in those spots, but just a heads up. And another note, after my first question, you'll hear from Guillermo, then Alejandro, and Alfonso last. What worries you and what gives you hope about the state of movie going and storytelling more broadly?
You know, I think that worry comes from the evolution of stories, that the culture starts passing you and you start worrying about things that seem logical to you from your generation's point of view. So nothing worries me in that sense. And what gives me hope is that people are starting to really emerge with new voices and with new proposals and daring proposals. That gives me a lot of hope, like to see new movies that are trying different ways of telling a story, you know, new rhythms, and new ways of seeing cinema, not just holding itself to the Aristotelian three-act structure, but playing with that.
Yeah, I think as Guillermo, I'm not worried, but I think the only concern will be that the technical aspect of the different ways the people is experiencing now films will affect the ideas behind. You know what I'm saying? I think the biggest thing that we should be aware as filmmakers, because I think we cannot control the technology, we cannot control the habits of the world audiences. That's something that is out of control of anybody's hand. Technological things will be keep moving with or without consent. But I think nobody should be surrendered to them and put ideas on that side, subordinated to them. I think if the ideas keep being thoughtful, brightness, and deep, powerful, no matter which media they will get through, the ideas will survive. The only other tools always will be evolving, not even ending. So we'll be seeing an evolutionary thing. So the ideas has to be king. I think that will be the concern, that suddenly we change the order of the importance of things, you know?
In terms of worries or concerns, I don't have so much worry, but as I'm curious. I'm curious because we're living a very specific time in cinema in which the paradigms are changing. And they are changing. It's such a big shift. What is happening now is as big as at the end of the 20s, the shift between silent film and talkies. And I'm really, really intrigued to see what is going to happen after. I hope that I get to see that. But on the other hand, the hope is that, you know, we've been blessed to have amazing masters before us and to have a great generation of other peers around us, and that the new generations, they are offering amazing cinema. So there's plenty of amazing films that inspire you. So I think that film will keep on, even with any change of paradigm, filmmakers will always find its way to create great cinema.
So there were a lot of really good movies that opened theatrically last year that basically nobody saw. Tar, She Said, Women Talking, Till among them. Instead, it's just the rich getting richer. So last year, little quiz, of the top 10 movies at the box office last year, how many were sequels?
10.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what does that say?
But look, let's take it one step at a time, because if you go back to classical Hollywood and you see the five sequels to the Thin Man movies or the Gold Diggers 33, Gold Diggers 34, like sequels and remakes and all that is not the problem. The problem, I think, is that the popular entertainment is confused with the importance of a movie, I think. I think that there are many movies that come out where they need theatrical size of ideas. And they need to land in a certain way to be considered important or permanent. I don't know. I think that the depth of the connection of some of those movies is not about box office. I don't think so. I think the industry tends to see it that way. But some of those movies are very important culturally for me.
And not only that, is some of those movies, yeah, you're talking about, they lasted a very short time in the theatrical release. But most of the films that you mentioned, these specific films, they're going to have long lives. And they will keep on, there will be experience in the decades to come. Well, some of those other films that made so much money, that was the end of it. That was the end of their life. I'm not saying all of them, but many of them. So we don't know about what is going to really endure. And I think that that's important aspect of cinema.
Posterity will play a joke on everyone. And the reality for me, having been one of the movies that was released on the week of Omicron and Spider-Man, same weekend, Nightmare Alley was Omicron, which annihilated the adult audience, and Spider-Man, which just destroyed at the box office. I still love that movie. And if it takes 10, 20 years for it to find its audience, I'm really okay with that. Now, as an industry, the other things are going to keep stomping the same ground. I'm more worried about the coincidence of how it will affect a generation that grew up with that as a norm. That I cannot calculate, because we grew up in 60s and 70s where the norm was a variety of movies. Now we have a generation coming up that grew up with sequels and franchises almost exclusively.
Yes, but by the same token, a generation that is exposed to an amazing amount of cinema
in other areas
worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, in other formats.
Yeah, on TV or on computer, that's what I mean, is we cannot calculate that.
But I think we cannot in a way disagree with what John is saying. I agree in a way that it's tragic that these other films has not been experienced in the big format as they should. I mean, that all the world cannot share that excitement at the times when you see a great movie in a great format and everybody's talking. That was incredible. The cultural impact is different than when it doesn't happen. But I agree with Alfonso that the films will survive for decades and years, and they will be experienced. So in a way, it's not black and white. Now, can we control that the people will not stop seeing films in the iPads, in computers, in TV, in phones? No, we can't control that. What we can control, I again make the point, is we just have to make sure as filmmakers that the idea is not the size of an iPhone. The idea has to be as big as a big screen. And then the other thing, it's going to be about the decision that the people will take. And lastly, I will say that I always kind of make a parallel with music industry. You know, before you can see only a classical or a concert in a music hall, and then it came the gramophone, and then it came the radio, and then it came the Walkman, and then now in our devices, in our headset.
MP3s.
And now what I'm saying is the amount of music that is produced now is incredible contemporary classic music, jazz, hip-hop, and some of that music, it belongs, and people just listen in their houses, and sometimes you go to a concert. So what I'm saying, the choices are incredible. Now, what are the most successful and blockbuster albums, the most commercial ones, but incredible music is available in everything that you want to do. So I think that's going to be the way for film. Unfortunately, because I share with you that it's incredible tragic that the great films are not shown in the big screen.
But John, and I think that the other thing is, I think the coin is flipping in the air. And look, we are in a decade where streaming came to maturity. It coincided with a massive world epidemic. We cannot know where the coin is going to land, if it's going to be head or tails this year or next year. It'll take a decade to know where we're going.
You all have made movies for Netflix, Roma, Bardo, and Pinocchio. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. Yep. But we're starting to see belt tightening among all the streamers. Warner Brothers Discovery is taking old content off its streaming sites as part of deep cost-cutting measures. Disney has lost $8 billion on streaming, $4 billion in the last year alone. Netflix says its new mandate is bigger, better, fewer. Mm-hmm. Does that concern you?
Well, I think studios behave like studios. I mean, they demolished the Phantom of the Opera stage to do the Transformers ride. It's not exactly like the mendacity has started only now. The mendacity existed in the 30s, on the 40s, on the 50s. But I think that if you only do studio movies, then you are only concerned about studio politics. But if you are a lot more malleable and you can work outside of that, you can and should.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The thing is that this is not the first time that this happens.
No.
This has happened in the past. And sometimes in cinema has proven to come in waves. And there are these periods in which suddenly it's only about action films. And there was no room for anything. There was not an action film or a romantic comedy. Yeah. And then the 90s came with an amazing flourishing of the indie cinema. And then again, the indie starts to fade away while other things come up. I'm less concerned about that than about the development of the cinematic language.
Yeah.
You know, which are the new routes that cinema is going to take. And that's up to the filmmakers. And yes, of course, we all dream of this beautiful, idealist scenario in which our films last for weeks and weeks and weeks in a cinema and a theater. But also we have to recognize where we are at. And, you know, I just want to dream that eventually also there's going to be a business that are going to find the need of audiences to go to see this other cinema in smaller theaters, maybe.
I mean, and 2004, when we were trying to do, after Blade 2 and we were doing Hellboy, superhero movies were no-no. Now, the reality of the culture is a really promiscuous clash between what the studios think they want, what they're going to want, and what the culture wants. And it's a sweaty, horrible clash of wills that nobody can predict. They may say whatever they want. What they'll do may be something different.
I think the tragedy of the film is, or the, you know, what we do is that it's an art form and it's a business. And that's the tragedy. That's when that realizes the tragedy of what we do is that. And I think since Wall Street came in, and now corporations and the quarterly kind of things for the guys that invest money, those are the kings. And obviously, the studios are serving just that and giving the people just what they want. That's a populist kind of approach. And then people will be, in a way, not getting what they maybe didn't know. They don't know that they will love that. And if everybody's just doing what people supposedly want, we will find an end. But I think there's room, and that's the paradox, I think, for me. The contradiction is that Roma could have not been made without a streaming service.
Nor Pinocchio.
Bardo will have never been done. Nobody in this town, I can have a lot of Oscars, you know, but, you know, doesn't matter. Nobody wants to make Bardo.
And Pinocchio was passed by every studio
so,
in town.
So that's what I'm saying. The irony and the paradox is that these streamers sometimes, they are putting gems in the screen and a lot of other things that I don't share. But without those opportunities, a lot of filmmakers will not be shooting now. In Mexico, 70% of the filmmakers are doing things with streamers, with everybody. What I'm saying is there's something that is now evolving to, I don't know what will be the end, but there's a very difficult time ahead to find out exactly. And again, the point is what Alfonso was saying, the language. If we subordinate the film to the TV language, the people will not have a reason to go to cinema.
Yeah.
If we make, let me put it this way, to put a film in a screen, in an IMAX, doesn't make it a good film. It doesn't make it a film. I have seen things in my computer that are masterpieces that they never had a chance, and I enjoy that more than a piece of shit in IMAX. So let's not confuse the conversation in the format. That's what I'm saying. Let's talk about cinema and what filmmakers can do.
It's the size of the idea, not the size of the screen.
Exactly. You know? The size of the idea, not the size of the
delivery
screen.
System.
You know, I think that's the dictatorship of the corporations has existed since the beginning.
And it's funny because we're having this conversation, but happens to be a very American conversation. And it has to be more specific American media conversation that it exists also in the UK and in Australia. Yeah. This conversation in which when we talk about cinema, we end up talking about the business. The business.
Which is not the only cinema that exists.
We're talking about commercial cinema. When cinema is way broader, the conversation in other countries tends to be about the films themselves and about what the film is bringing or not bringing. It's about many other things. Yeah. I think that the conversation has drifted too far into business and into the industry and business. And then before, cinema used to be part of the cultural conversation. Now cinema has become part of, at least in the US, part of the business conversation. Mm-hmm.
Can I make a parallel? It's about if we talk about coffee and we end up about the profit of Starbucks. Yes, Starbucks, yeah, but coffee is a culture that is lived in many different ways around the world in different environments.
In Italy, it's
exactly.
You talk about
no,
coffee.
We can have a passion, I think, about coffee and the flavor and if it's African, Colombian. But when we talk about the obsession of Starbucks, then we are reducing the whole possibilities, I think.
Coming up after the break, we'll pick up where we left off with Mexican filmmakers Guillermo del Toro, Alfonso Cuarón, and Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Now let's get back to my conversation with filmmakers Alfonso Cuarón, Alejandro González Iñárritu, and Guillermo del Toro. You'll hear Guillermo reference Cha-Cha-Cha. That's the production company the three started together in 2007. I want to ask you about collaboration and about when you're working with one another,
How do you make sure that you are helping that other person make the best version of his film and not the best version of what you think his film should be?
We never would do that. I mean, we
that's
no.
That's a good question. That's a very good question.
Good, but,
for me, it's a good question.
I mean, every time we are, we know the three of us are stubborn. But we know also that if there's a point where you the other won't see a point, even if you think you're right, it's not his point. And I don't think we've ever really...
No, but even in the occasions that could happen, it's very different because we know each other so well.
Yeah.
That I know the tendencies of Guillermo, yes. The tendencies of Alejandro. I'm sure they know my tendencies of what I like or how I would do things.
Yeah.
So we understand where the other person is coming from. And the important thing is to understand what is behind the approach. What is the essence of the suggestion?
And we rarely say, I told you so. Rarely.
Between the two of you, I don't know. Between the two of you, that happens more often.
It does. Yeah. Well, no. But I think that there's three levels.
Guillermo could have done a masterpiece if he should have listened to me. Yeah, maybe he will have a good masterpiece.
No, but like we have three conversations. One before the movie is made.
Yes.
One after the movie is made, and one after the movie is released. And in the three, there are very different needs. But I think that we know each other very well. They have warned me. Both of them have warned me when I'm about to make a mistake, and I go ahead and make it. And I know they know, and I know. Everybody knows we know.
What's an example?
I can't. But no. But I think that what we can be is brutal and honest and well-intentioned. That's it. I mean, when we had the company, cha-cha-cha, and one of the best decisions we made was to close it.
Why?
Because we realized if we keep going this way, we're going to just... It's like, it's very cool to have a pet dragon, but you got to keep feeding it every day. And we said, this is going to end the friendship.
I tell you, is that we are used to have certain kind of conversation that is mostly about life and then about cinema.
Not business.
And we found that every time we talked to each other was just about business, and we would dread to talk to each other because we have to sort this stuff out from management of the whole situation.
Yeah, the joy was gone.
The joy was gone.
That and the fact that Alejandro took longer to come up with the goddamn logo of the company than the company lasted. We had it in one movie, and then we closed.
No, but you know, what I think is very interesting, what you said, is that that line between when you think that you are giving a good advice and then, as Guillermo said, sometimes the advice that you gave end up being the good advice and then you have to commit your mistakes and learn from them. But sometimes you think that you have a good advice and then you were wrong, and that's beautiful. I remember once I visited you in Gravity and I visited the set, and you and Chivo were trying to figure out, there was this moment that Sandra Bullock was kind of with Arnaz flying in the rocket in the studio, and there was this very complicated movement. I think you were shooting when the drop of the water was in, and the camera was moving, and the crane, and the Arnaz was not working, and the camera was getting into the Arnaz, and Sandra's movement was super uncomfortable to make, was blah, 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 blah. And it was a one shot, obviously super complicated. And I was there and I said to Alfonso, you know, have you considered maybe to cover a little bit from this angle and just cover your ass in order that if you don't get it, blah, blah. And he said, no. And I said, cabrón, just do it just for your sanity, just to have it in. And he said, no, if I do it, I know that I will use it and I don't want to use it. So I don't want to even give me that chance. And I went out there very wary. I said, it's one of those things that you, as a friend, said, oh, my God. And he fucking nailed it. And it would have been, if he would have heard me, I would have given a bad advice because he knew what he was doing. Yeah. So his stubbornness comes from a vision and not from a bad idea. So it for me was more like a cowardly kind of thing to protect this guy. You know, that's the classic example.
There is artistic advice and there is emotional advice. And artistic is like how the movie's going to get made, or you're saying to Alfonso, you should cover it this way. Emotional is like when something doesn't go well or you're in a dark place, you don't think your movie's working. How much would you say your collaboration, your partnership, your friendship is also that part that you're helping each other when somebody's not feeling good. Like you can lift somebody up and talk to them about what is working rather than just get into the details of a shot, that you can actually emotionally support each other when you're not feeling good.
Well, filmmakers mostly talk about films, but even if a film goes wrong, we try to contextualize it in a beautiful way, but we share family stories.
Yeah, but most of it, I mean, even when we talk about film, there's always the aspect of, the screenplay and then the editing and notes and whatever. But a lot, I think that most of our conversations are about our state of being while we're doing something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like how we're dealing with situations.
Yeah.
And
we've all been through rough stuff, all of us, in this 16 years.
No, I think the privilege and the blessing side of this friendship, John, is that we have a very privileged job, obviously. We are very privileged men in that sense. But at the same time, this job is not easy. It's very risky and it's very lonely. So to share and walk with somebody in tough times and good times, to when somebody's success is your success and somebody's failure is your failure, and you share that, honestly, that's something that I think very few people can say it truly. And because we understand where we are sitting at, and we come from another country, we don't belong in that sense truly from here. We just, in a way, there's a lot of things that unite us in our past. Yeah. I think that make it even more strong, because if you will be Australian or American, whatever, but we share a past and a point of view. So I think to share failure with somebody make it much more easier.
And success.
That's the beauty of the friendship, you know?
Very last question. If you are, and I know none of you are, a professional figure skater, when you are not competing, you're working every day with a coach, and that coach is helping you perfect your art. There's no equivalent for filmmaking, I don't think. I don't think there's an equivalent for novelists, maybe for composers. So when you think about how do you stay sharp, how do you get inspired, where do you look for inspiration, what would you say those things are?
For me, it's napping.
For me, it's watching movies.
For me, it's just honestly, just be literally aware that life is passing. I was telling that just the last 15 days, you suddenly realize that the sky is blue and the clouds are kind of white and you have a hot tea in your hands. And suddenly that kind of being present, not intellectually engaged necessarily with something, but just observing things happening in your body, in your emotions, and obviously the things that happen. I think those always for me are the moments that in that space, in that silence, in that non-action is when something comes. So, I mean, I really look for those moments, which are the most precious for me, you know.
Alfonso?
Yeah, it's similar in the sense that, as Guillermo says, definitely watching films is always very inspiring. But the bottom line is life. I guess that if we do this, at that particular, I guess that the kind of films that Alejandro, Guillermo, and I would do, we need to be completely not only committed, like from a standpoint of time, but very emotionally involved. And in order to do that, it needs to kind of convey our state of being on life. Mm-hmm. And it's more about a life process. Because and that's interesting, because a lot of what we talk about when we complete a film, either is successful or is a failure, is about the impact in our lives. Mm-hmm. And what, in many ways, the lessons that we can take out of the experience.
I agree.
Just lastly, I want to say that in my case, I have never been chasing movies. Anyway, suddenly the movies appear, and then in the last 10 years, at least, in the beginning, yes, but now is things appear, and then it's how I subordinate that film for my life, how I adapt my life to that film, and how the film will be adapted to the life, and how that film can project what is true to me in my life. And the extreme case is Bardo. O sea, Bardo is the end of that process, I think.
No, for me, it is the thing that I notice is that I am more me the older I get in terms of the language I use, the solutions I do, and how the movies matter or reveal who I am, and they become deeply biographical. It's so strange, but Pinocchio is as biographical as I can get. Is he did Roma, he did Bardo, I did Pinocchio, and they are ultimately biographical in a very oblique way, all of them. All of them.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm very biographical. And you know, Pinocchio takes 15 years to get made.
I know.
And not the fact that we don't give up, we still don't give up, that is how you stay sharp. Do you still want to make them? Yes. Do you still want to make them about what hurts? Yes. Then you have a coach. Torture.
Cabrones, hasta la próxima vez. Muchas gracias por el tiempo.
My man, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Retake. We'll see you again next week. I'm John Horn. Retake is produced and engineered by Michael Cosentino and Monica Bushman. The editor is Suzanne Levy. And a special thanks to the entire KPCC LAS newsroom. Support for this podcast is made possible by Gordon and Donna Crawford, who believe that quality journalism makes Los Angeles a better place to live.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.